Right now, it's going to time to be joined by David Terechuk. It's time for the Media Beat with David. David joins us here on a Friday morning live, and we also rebroadcast David over the course of the weekend and following our new news on Monday. David has his own website, which is themediabeat.us. He's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. Good morning, David. How are you this morning?
Well, I'm glad to be with you, reporting from the media capital of the world as regularly. Once upon a time, it was regular anyway. I took a long break, I know, but I'm back in the media capital of the world, and it's a good place to be.
Well, it is, and there's a lot to talk about, and I want to talk about the major's address, which was only 20 minutes long last night, that was given by Joe Biden. I mentioned this earlier to my my meteorologist, and the difference of presidents over the past 4 years and now is you're driving a car and your muffler is really loud and annoying, and then you go get it fixed and it's not loud. You know, one thing Joe Biden brings to the table, and it's an important thing, is you may not agree with his politics, you may not agree with his policies, but he brings a level of compassion and calm, I think, which is really needed at this time.
Well, yes, you saw Biden doing what Biden's best at, I think. People keep stressing in the media, and they should, I guess. I mean, it's the, the unavoidable fact of Biden's political style is the man's empathy, and, of course, that people say that derives from the personal tragedies he's had in his life and his struggle through them, and his ability to relate to other people's pain. And it was interesting to see that the way he did it was very classic. It was the East Room of the White House. It was not him sitting at the Resolute desk in the Oval Office. There was a certain amount of calm, deliberative quality to that setting. It was, it's the long room with a very long red carpet and many flags either side. A certain degree of pomp, but not overstated. It's a very typically American leadership symbol, I think. And you know, as you say, he brought a degree of calm to his delivery, and in fitting with the seriousness, that's what it is, I guess, the main quality that he wanted to convey of the address to the nation exactly 1 year since the COVID was declared to be a global pandemic. And, of course, writing on his signing that very afternoon of the extraordinarily large relief package for COVID that he signed. There'll be another more sort of presentational event in the White House today, signing it with a large audience. But the functional thing of putting pen to paper and declaring that that act active happened before he went to speak to the nation, and in a way, Biden was doing something about the political scene, which is important for the next 2 years, 4 years, setting the table, as it were, for the American electorate, and the big question that we'll be facing it over these next 2 to 4 years. Is the American electorate going to approve Biden's aggressive and expensive efforts to climb out of our deep and desperate COVID hole? Or are they going to believe that it's too expensive for the taxpayer and unnecessary? That's the main Republican argument, of course. And you know, he made an appeal for unity around this necessary program, in his view, expensive but necessary program. He was at pains to describe unity as not a matter of what politicians in Washington do. It's a matter of what Americans as a whole throughout the country do. And you know, he's has from a standpoint, from his starting point, is is a comfortable one for him, and the polls are favoring him. 62 to some of them saying 70% of Americans approve this package, and that includes two-fifths of Republicans, almost all Democrats, of course, and a very sizable majority of independents. So that's what he's attempting to strike as an attitude for the way going forward. And it was a very typically adept politician's performance last night by Biden. I think most media commentators would acknowledge that.
It was interesting in the lines that really, one line struck out to me. Unlike a presidential address where you're being told, he emphasized over and over again, "I need you." He did not at all talk from upon high and say, "Listen to this. This is what's going on." I need you. And that's a different way to reach the American people. And, you know, people might say, well, it's political speak. It is political speak, but it is, you know, people like to hear the fact that, hey, they're the ones that can control this if they follow this plan.
Yeah, with a 50-50 Senate and a not especially strong majority in the House, he does need support throughout the country, regardless of what may go on inside the Beltway. And it's interesting that his effort to rally support, public support for this, which will be carried out through a pretty intense timetable of visits by himself and Vice President Kamala Harris over the next weeks, is all very carefully thought out. I mean, I spent my time away from the country the last 2 months when I was overseas in Europe. I was reading Obama's own a memoir of his first term, and one of the things that is pretty clear, it comes out of the book very clearly, is that he's quite peeved at the fact that his massive stimulation package to get us out of the deep recession, which he put before the nation in 2009, he never really got credit for it. And it's interesting that, historically, Biden was one of the people who was telling Obama at that time that he should go around the nation stumping and rallying support for it, and not just toss it out from the center in Washington, D.C., and expect that its effects would be self-evident. That's not quite what he did. That's not solely what he did. He did attempt to rally, but he didn't do the intensive program that clearly Biden wanted him to do, and what Biden is now doing for himself. It's an interesting exercise in political contrast, not as deep and strong as you mentioned earlier. he's not the rattling muffler at all. He's the quiet, calming presence. When you contrast him with the previous guy, as Trump is now being called by Biden, a nice label, I think. But the contrast with his own boss 8 years ago, until 8 years ago, is an interesting contrast too.
And I also like the fact that, because hey, I'm in radio and I like to watch movies, he tied it in with July 4th as being like another. It sounds corny, but you know what? I think it's a great idea, saying, hey, July 4th is Independence Day. We won't only celebrate the independence, but hopefully will be the day where families can start to get together in small numbers, and we can be a little more independent from the COVID virus.
Yeah, Biden's message is essentially pain, his capacity to embrace both pain and hope. The idea of light at the end of the tunnel represented by a blazing barbecue on July 4th is absolutely suited to his approach to a T. It was an interesting and I think rather effective political exercise.
Now, I want to go from the United States and Joe Biden to Thailand. And reports from the BBC today that Thailand has now delayed the rollout of the AstraZeneca vaccination because of fears over blood clots.
Yeah, and they're not the only country either. Denmark in Europe too, and a couple of other countries are doing the same thing. It's hard to say how serious this concern is. AstraZeneca AstraZeneca vaccine that was developed at Oxford University has come in for some bad PR hits since its launch. In many ways, it had a good start. Its trials looked every bit as good as Pfizer and Moderna, but there were certain degrees, certain aspects of their trials which weren't covered to the degree that those two previous vaccines trials were. We didn't know, for instance, in as much detail how well it would work with people over a certain age. Over 65, I think, was the marker point. And that prompted Germany, for one country, very early on to say that they had doubts about it, certainly for that sector of the population. Now, all of this is conducted at the same time as medical authorities were approving the vaccine at the same time. Europe's own medication and medical devices regulator gave the AstraZeneca vaccine an all clear, even while these worries about the age concern for over 65s was being expressed. And again now, even in the face of this low number, very low numbers of blood clot problems occurring, the authorities overall are still saying that it's a perfectly fine vaccine. But that doesn't stop individual jurisdictions deciding for themselves. And it's troubling because, of course, and Thailand is a very telling example of this. The main point to register, I think, globally about the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine is it is the one which the World Health Organization has been given in huge numbers to use as part of its COVAX program, the program that will ensure, that it's intended to ensure, that countries, poorer countries who can't afford their own purchases of Moderna and Pfizer will have it to use instead, and then it's being manufactured in enormous quantity, mainly in India, to service the poorer nations of the world. So it's not a good sign if a country like Thailand says, no thanks, we're worried about it. How long they stay worried about it is an open question. I have a feeling that that all the authoritative forces in the medical world will be geared towards ensuring that this vaccine is seen to be, is made to be, and is seen to be a perfectly valid and valuable vaccine.
All right, now I have to go here. I'm sorry about this in advance. I apologize in advance. I'm really getting tired of what goes on with Meghan Markle, Harry, and the whole situation. What goes on with this, with the royal family? This, you know, they shouted questions at the king to be, and he indicated he hadn't spoken to his brother yet. Is this as big a story in England as it's being made here on American media?
Oh, dear Marshall, as you all know, my heart sinks when we have to turn to the royals. It's an industry, and the institution of monarchy in the UK is a massive part of its national framework. I mean, it is an industry in itself. It's a huge element of the British tourist industry, as you know. But it's also an industry in the media. Covering the royal family is a business in itself, with its own rules and its own. I was going to use the word ethics, but it seems inappropriate because there's very little ethical thinking going on amongst the tabloids, particularly who specialise in covering the royal family. Now, is it a big story in Britain? Of course it is. It's appallingly and disappointingly so. At the base of it is a piece of doublethink, a mental exercise, a kind of mental gymnastics that almost beggars belief if you think about it seriously. I guess the question is anyone in their right mind surprised at all that such a deeply conservative institution, based on the idea, after all, of authority based on birth, is a racist an outfit in its outlook? A racist outfit in its outlook, which is, I think, a fair description of that organization. Individuals in it may not be racist, but the whole approach of the institution, of course, is based on the kind of thinking that characterizes racist behavior and racist attitudes, for sure. Now, when the king-to-be, as you describe him, you're assuming that King Charles might be a king first, but Prince William is destined to be king. When journalists shout questions at him, and he gave the rather brief answers he gave at all yesterday, it's striking in the sense that his job usually, and in normal times such as they are, when people lob questions at Prince William, or indeed his younger brother, the royal behavior expected in reply is silence. You ignore those questions if you're the prince. In this case, he did say something. So suddenly, it's a huge story. He said they're not a racist family, and he said he hadn't talked to his brother yet. And somehow or other, that in the British context, that translates into a huge story. Now, neither of those facts, one protestation, is nothing in itself. And yet, somehow or other, the royal coverage being what it is, and the people conducting it being who they are and what kind of people they are, you'll notice that I have very, very little respect for this branch of journalistic expertise. Then it ends up as an appallingly big story, and heads are rolling. A journalist, Piers Morgan, who when Time Warner was still a big media empire, Time Warner decided that Piers Morgan was a worthy successor to Larry King, and his talk show was conducted in America by Piers Morgan for a while, and Piers Morgan was constantly on television in Britain, and then suddenly he got into this imbroglio and said that he didn't, what was his phrase about Meghan? He said, "I don't believe a word she says." He's entitled to his view, but boy, was there a volcanic eruption in response to that. And the next day, he walked off the set of his television program. So that's the kind of flurry that's going on. Is it a big story? Well, it's a big, noisy story, like your metaphorical muffler in a car. But is it important? Of course it's not. And I will repeat what I said from Ireland when I was commenting on the Meghan and Harry story rather earlier this year. Why don't we just leave them alone?
There you go. And you know what's Piers Morgan, when Larry King died and CNN was rolling over backward to praise him, just remember CNN fired Larry King and hired Piers Morgan. I'm sure the executives that were involved in that are spending some time in hell right now.
I don't know. It was one of those baffling experiments that sometimes take place in the media. I wonder what goes on in the executive rooms of media organizations. And sometimes I wish I was a fly on the wall, and sometimes I'm very glad that I'm not a fly on the wall in that case.
All right. And China makes no doubt about it. One, you can say what you want about China, but on certain things, they make no doubt about it. And basically, they put an end to any scuttlebutt that they think that people in Hong Kong are going to really have, two countries and two rules. No, Hong Kong is going to be ruled exactly like China is ruled. They made that very, very, very clear yesterday. And it's going to be interesting how it affects Hong Kong's position in the financial world.
Sure. China and the Chinese Communist Party are a behemoth, and that was demonstrated very clearly during the rubber stamping, that's what it was, by the Chinese Communist Party's so-called People's Congress that put the official approval as if it was needed on their plans to tighten the grip even further on China. But the whole problem presented, the global problem presented by China, not just in Hong Kong but in the whole of the Asian region, is one that is getting Biden's attention, and I think it's important to point out that this is not this is a story that's not been making major headlines, but today Biden's new approach to China is surfacing very clearly. There will be a summit of leaders of four countries. The event is known as the Quad, because it's four countries, very important countries that are affected by China, who believe themselves to be affected seriously by China. That's apart from the United States itself, it's Japan, India, and Australia. And it'll be a virtual summit, of course. They won't be meeting physically in person together. But leaders of all four countries will be addressing the problem of China. And this is another instance of Biden's businesslike, if you like, if I can put it that way, businesslike approach to a major problem like China. He's getting down to business. They are correlating. He's not going to try and do it together. It's not going to be tariffs and a trade war one-on-one between the United States and China. There will be a correlated effort with allies. And of course, it'll involve some military saber-rattling. The four countries will engage in joint military exercises in Asian waters, and sending a clear message to China that way. So diplomatic relations will be conducted, in a very different way than they were in the last 4 years, and perhaps more, and we might hope, perhaps rather more constructively.
Yeah, it won't be diplomacy by tweet.
That's right. Yeah. It's strange, isn't it? As we check our Twitter feed now, it's still a little. I'm still finding it a little hard to adjust. Again, it's that quiet muffler reassessing itself. Very different from the noisy muffler we had for 4 years.
Well, it's once again, there's some things in world politics that need to be kept out of sight when the negotiations are going on, and Joe Biden has returned our government, and I think all the allies of the United States who have problems and need a strong United States appreciate that. Well, David, it's always great to talk with you, and we'll see what happens in the next week or so as we look at what's going on in the world. We appreciate once again you joining us this morning.
We'll report what the media says about it this time next week.
All right, David, take care. Have a great week.
You too. Bye now.
David Tarachuk, the media beat here on Robin Hood Radio. You'll find him on robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand. Click on David Tarachuk with the media beat. Also his own website, themediabeat.us.